This is Starters for the Rest of Us, episode 61. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
I am within days of getting this new design launched on Hittail, man. I used so many bad words last week. I think not on the podcast, but right before it and after it. Just burning time, but I got through that within a day or two, and feeling really good. So I'm going to take at least 2 weeks off, and I'm basically trying to get this thing done and out before Christmas. Trying to get her done.
So it'll be 8 to 12 days?
8 to 12 days, exactly, sir. It's cool. I'm excited to take some time off, but I'm not excited to take it off if this isn't ready. You know what I'm saying? It's going to be on my mind. So I'm hoping to take, like I said, 2 weeks off. And then my wife today is actually on, she took off yesterday, went to the coast. It's about 2.5 hours away and got a hotel room. And so I'm watching the kids, and she's basically thinking and mapping out like the next couple years of her like personal goals and what she wants to do in her career. She's a college professor and a therapist. She's a psychologist. And so she's looking at all this stuff. And I'm going to be doing the same thing, hopefully, the first week of January. So I'm going to take off for just one overnight, have about 36 hours to myself, and I will almost certainly have some updates on my plans for 2012 once I get back from that. So I really want to leave and do that with a kind of a fresh mind, having Hittail pretty much ready to launch the new design when I get back. My goal was to get it launched before, but there's no chance I'm going to finish this thing and push it live and then go on 2 weeks of vacation, because I know that there'll be bugs and there'll be little crashes and such, and I don't want to be dealing with them over the holidays.
Cool.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, as of last week, Audit Shark has finally hit what I would consider to be MVP status. So it's minimally viable at this point. I could sell it and not feel terribly ashamed about anything that people see inside of it. I was working today to get basically just walk through the installation process, because I put together an installation guide or an installation document to, you know, complete with screenshots and everything else. It basically walks somebody through right after they've set up an account. It will walk them through installing the Windows service that sits on their machines. And I actually ran into a few issues in trying to do a clean slate deployment. So I have to figure out what those things are. I think it's more in my build process than anything else. Everything works on my develop machine. Everything works on my other development machine. The only place it doesn't actually work is on a clean slate. So I have to figure out exactly what's going on there. But I'm fairly certain that it's just a configuration problem, and once I get that straightened out, then it'll be all set. And I've got somebody who has kind of volunteered to go ahead and install it in a lab environment and start running it and see how things go.
Nice. And have you, you know, after our conversation last week, what was episode 60, we're already getting some comments, some good in-depth comments. So if you haven't heard episode 60 already, definitely recommend going back. Since then, have you talked to anyone? Have you what kind of progress or thoughts have you made on the marketing front?
Not really much. I was just kind of finishing off the bells and whistles to get to get Audit Shark to what I consider to be that MVP status. I did notice that there was a comment on there from Ted. I think it was more addressing my point about using resellers and stuff, and how that was a giant red flag. And I might have misused the term or misrepresented the term resellers a bit. What I really had in mind was people who essentially had customers where they already had an established relationship with them, who would be willing to essentially walk me into their accounts. And the purpose of that would be to essentially have them identify potential opportunities and then essentially put me in touch with those people. So it's not really them necessarily acting as a reseller. I mean, maybe they'll be there side by side or, you know, with me while I'm doing like a sales presentation or anything like that. But it's not like I would be just be turning it over to them and saying, oh, here you go, here's something that you can resell. And there's three main targets for that. One is for auditors who go into customers and they have to go out into the customer environment and get the information. And those people would be willing to identify their customers because then they wouldn't have to actually go into the customer's environment and do it themselves. The other two are very similar. One is service providers, managed service providers, and one of them is consulting companies. Managed service providers essentially completely manage your environment. It's almost like going with a managed hosting environment versus an unmanaged hosting environment, where I guess the primary difference is people are more hands-on with a managed hosting environment. Well, with a managed service provider, you're essentially outsourcing part of your IT operations to them. So they're already billing people on a monthly basis, and those people are already used to being billed on a monthly basis for various services. And in each of those cases, the idea would be that, you know, obviously I'm going to be selling to the customer and they're going to be working with me. And what I was trying to get across in the podcast was how to compensate them, but I'd forgotten that one of the ideas that I had for essentially compensation for those managed service providers and those consulting companies was that once I've identified the problems in the customer's environment, they're going to need to somehow fix them. And who's going to be able to fix them? Well, that managed service provider or that consulting company that they've already got an established relationship with. The purpose of those, I don't want to call them reseller arrangements, really. I guess a more appropriate term would be service providers. But the purpose of those is really just to cut down on the number of false leads that I'm following up on, because it's very random to be able to just walk into a bank and say, hey, can I talk to somebody in the IT department? And either you get in or you don't. I mean, it's very time consuming. And the idea of using those and leveraging those people is to try and cut down on the number of places that I'm going into where I'm not going to get anywhere.
So I think there's a lot of, I mean, like I said last time, I think there's a lot of complexity with that model, and that it'll take a lot of time to get a reseller up to speed. I want to see you try it and see it work for me to kind of understand more of what it's going to look like. There, I still have a lot of questions about how you're going to convince a company to spend the time to learn your software. I guess you're going to have to offer them a nice chunk of commission and that.
Well, that's what I was originally thinking, but like there's a company near where I live that, and I've already talked to them about this. I mean, they have an $8 million a year managed services. But they have all these customers, probably 200 or 300 customers that pay them on a monthly basis for various services. So they're constantly talking to these people. They've got sales reps who are constantly working with them, trying to figure out what it is that they need and what sort of other services they can provide. And if I can go into their customers and, you know, they've already told me, we would love to have you work with us to help identify the problems in our customers' environments so that we can then go in and charge them to fix those things.
It definitely makes sense what you're saying. What my concern is that you now have two customers, right? You're now selling to end users and you're also selling to resellers.
Yeah, I'm not really selling to them though.
You have to convince them that there's enough of a market that they should invest a lot of time into learning your product and into pushing your product and into supporting your product. You know what I'm saying? Like, you really are. You have to convince them.
I see what you're saying.
It's a sales effort there. They don't have to buy it, but there's a sales effort nonetheless. There was a couple other things. One is, you know, we've been kind of given updates on how MicroConf is coming together. And I wanted to let people know we're planning to start selling tickets in January, where we'll have, you know, we'll have the exact location and dates and all that stuff. But if you're a listener and if you did not attend last year, I recommend you go to microconf.com. We'll link it up in the show notes. We have a mailing list because we're going to give, well, two things. One, we're definitely going to give discounts to, you know, people who are on the early mailing list and anyone who attended last year. And the tickets are going to be cheaper than if you're just the general public. The second thing is we are limiting the number of tickets we're selling. We got a lot of feedback last year that one of the coolest parts of the conference was how small it was. And it was about 110 attendees. And so what we're going to do this year, we've talked about doing, it's 2 to the 7th power, which is 128. So we're talking about limiting it to 128 attendees. And I don't know, you know, at that level, with the level of interest that we have and the size of, you know, we have several mailing lists, I'm pretty confident it's going to sell out fairly quickly. So if you are interested in coming, it's going to be in Las Vegas in mid to late April. I would definitely, you know, go to microconf.com and get your name on the list.
You know, I told you last week that the previous week we pushed off the podcast because of my medical issues with my back. And my back has been doing a little bit better. I've been having some weird pains here and there in my leg, which I may attribute to nerves. I may attribute to just not stretching out. But I think overall things are a lot better, and I'm hoping that that trend continues. We'll see if it turns out that I eventually need surgery. I'll probably find out sometime next month. One of the things that I found separate from that is that how long have I been working on AutoShark here? You know, or at least how long have we been talking about it on this podcast? Like 8 months, 10 months, something like that?
Well, it's December, and you originally, I mean, we originally talked about you getting to Alpha in June, which is 6 months ago. So I know that you, it could easily be January. I could imagine it being a year.
Right. And it's not like I've really taken what I would consider a major break from it either. So, I mean, I've really been kind of pushing hard ever since I'll call it that missed deadline back in July or August or whatever it was that I ended up setting, because I think I ended up missing the first one because of MicroConf, and that set me back a couple of months. And then I ran into all these other things that I didn't necessarily account for during the development and things that I needed to implement that took me just a lot more time than I ever thought that they possibly would. You know, having pushed through all of that, I'm at the point where, or I've gotten to the point in the past couple of weeks where I've just realized that, like, I am severely burnt out. So I've tried to step back a little bit and maybe trying to figure out how to get my mojo back a little bit. So, you know, you and I both know that when you're building stuff, you're in this create mode, and in the past I basically cut off all my podcasts, all my additional reading, all the additional information consumption that I was doing in order to focus on just churning out code and being creative about how I put things together. And over the past week or so, I've taken a step back and tried to get into the consumption mode a little bit again, just to kind of, I guess, recharge the batteries. And one of the podcasts I've really found to be helpful with that is the Lifestyle Business Podcast with Dan and Ian. And Dan was on a couple of weeks ago, but I just want to say thanks to you guys for, you know, just helping lift my spirits and morale and everything, because being in that constant mode is just, you know, it wears on you after a while when you don't actually have customers, you haven't actually launched yet. It's funny, all the parallels between their podcast and ours is just very similar, but obviously I'm not hearing my own voice talk.
Right. No, I would totally agree on both points, man. When I cut myself off totally, because we do, you go through the ebb and flow of kind of being able to consume and being able to absorb it and process it. And then you go through the times where you're just so busy creating that you really can't take any more input. And I find that when I get in the creation phases, it's great, but I can't do it for more than a couple months before I burn out pretty hard. And then I need to go back to having some involvement in the community. And I've done it a lot with audio, with books, and with podcasts. I totally hear what you're saying. And I'd also definitely give a shout out to Lifestyle Business Podcast. So I have a couple other things. The first is, I don't know if you saw it on TechCrunch, but WP Engine raised a round of funding. WordPress Engine, which is Jason Cohen of a Smart Bear, his company. And I was one of the angel investors.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? He emailed me and mentioned, he said it was like a closed round. It was like invite only or something. And so he and I have known each other for a couple of years, and I was obviously completely floored and very, very flattered. You look at the names, it's like big name venture capital firm in Austin, Eric Reese, Dharmesh Shah. And then I'm like, wait, and dot, 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 dot. And Rob Walling. I mean, I so don't fit on that list. So I was totally, totally flattered that he asked. And it was cool. So I don't see myself becoming a big angel investor. I never would have approached him or anything, but it was fun to be a part of it. And now I actually moved my blog there from Dreamhost. And that's been nice. You know, as much as I like Dreamhost, I have so many sites on there. I am having problems with my virtual server at this point, and getting my blog off there, which is, you know, getting quite a bit of traffic these days, has helped. So WP Engine, y'all.
You're going to totally pimp it out now.
But that and buying Hittail has really kind of tapped me out for a while. So it's been good that my other businesses can continue to do all right. Two more things. One is, I have this 2012 prediction that I want to throw out. There's this website. Have you heard of it? It's called Pinterest. It's like interest, but with a P in front of it. Pinterest.com.
I have not.
This site, my prediction is that 2012 is going to be the year of Pinterest. It's a social network. It's like a visual social pin board. And so you create pin boards, and you can just pin images to them, and then you can share them with other people. The reason I think it's going to be big is, within the span of maybe 30 days, three different friends in three different social circles who are not techies told my wife about it. It's right now, it's a female-driven website. I could totally see, I mean, obviously there's some men using it, but I could see it, you know, becoming more gender balanced. But guaranteed, it's pulling in I mean, one of our friends is a physician. She's our age. My wife's a psychologist, PhD in psychology. I mean, they're educated. They're like the demographic that people want to attach to. So I seriously think Pinterest is going to be big. The reason I mention it is they don't have an API yet, but they're working on one. And I feel like some folks are going to get in on the ground floor. Well, I guess we'll see in 6 months if I'm correct. And you're going to try it out, aren't you?
No.
And last thing for me, I've read two books in the past couple months that I really wanted to share with people. One is if you're going to be doing high touch sales, because I'm kind of ramping up, you know, I've always done more inbound marketing and low touch sales, and I'm looking to do some higher touch sales with Hittail. There's this book called The Ultimate Sales Machine by Chet Holmes that is ridiculously good. So I wanted to recommend that to people. I listen to it on audio, which I often do, and I liked it so much that I bought the physical paper copy, which I have not bought a paper book in months, but I just want it around for reference. I want to be able to flip through it and take notes and do that stuff that I can't do with the Kindle or audio version. And then the other one is more about finding goals and designing lifestyle, and it's called The Art of Nonconformity. Chris Guillebeau has a blog that's quite popular. It's also under the same name. I actually recommended this book to my wife, who's not typically into this kind of stuff. She read it, and she went on that 2-day kind of vision quest, and she's using it as a guideline to help shape what she thinks she might do over the next couple of years. I'm probably going to be doing the same when I go off in early January. If you're wondering, like, what the hell am I doing and what's going to make me happy? Like, how do I want to shape my career? How do I want to shape my personal life? It's a really good book. The guy's a really good writer. He's done a lot of his stuff. He's had a lot of experiences. I highly recommend it.
Very cool. So we're going to move on to some of the letters from our listeners for this week. We do have a number of questions that have been streaming in, which we, I think, have been severely neglecting over the past several weeks, partially due to how far ahead we got on some of our podcast episodes. So the first one is a discussion that I got into with a person named Tomas from PlanMySite.com. And PlanMySite.com is a web design company based out of New Jersey. And through the course of the discussion, we were discussing some web design stuff. But one of the things that kind of stuck with me was the fact that email is a notoriously terrible communication device. And I know that, like, Jeff Atwood has serious reservations about using email for virtually anything and absolutely hates it. He much prefers Twitter over email. But, you know, Twitter's got its problems, too. I mean, you're limited to 140 characters. But I think that when you're trying to use email, the issue that comes up is you're better off probably just getting on the phone with somebody, because once you start writing more than a couple of paragraphs, things just go downhill quick. I mean, things can easily get misinterpreted, and you start making assumptions about what the other person meant. You know, it just starts to go down the wrong road. Just one of the conclusions that, you know, he and I came to was email is just awful.
Yeah, I'm finding that the more I use email over the years, the shorter my emails are getting. And mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing. Have you seen the 3 sentences and 4 sentences stuff?
I have.
For if a listener hasn't heard, the domain name is like threesentence.es or something like that. If you Google it, you can
see
it.
There's 3, 4, and 5.
Yep.
Actually.
And so some people put the link to that. All that website says is all of my emails are 3 sentences long. And if you just put that link at the bottom of your email and your signature, people might understand why you're so brief. I don't do that because I do like to preserve the right to go on and on and on. But but at the same time, I find that when I'm emailing with friends or acquaintances or people I'm very familiar with, I think I actually find email to be pretty good because people know your intonation. They know you're not being an ass when you're being sarcastic. You know, they don't take offense. Whereas, yeah, if you're in a discussion with someone brand new who emails you, it is so easy to just have things get out of control pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what is email good for? I think email is good for, it's like brief messages. It's certainly when you want to keep stuff private. I find Twitter painful to have a discussion over because of the 140 character limit. So I do like email more than Jeff Atwood does. You know what I'm saying? I do still use it quite a bit. I would agree.
Somebody should come out with Twitter that doesn't limit you to 140 characters. It limits you to 5 periods.
Google Plus doesn't limit you. Although I use a lot of dot, dot, dots in my email, so that would kind of hose me.
It would. It would. Anyway, I do want to say thanks to Tomas for having that discussion with me. So let's move on to the next question. This question is from Ray, and he says, "Hi, guys. Finally got around to writing a review and hope you can help me with this problem. Gmail is fine, but I really want to be able to send and receive email like a dozen email addresses for each of the domains I own and manage. I think you said just forward everything to your email, but when it comes to sending, I don't want my emails to come through as myname@gmail.com on behalf of so-and-so. I want to look like I'm an actual business. Outlook forces me to have separate email boxes. I just want to have one inbox and have the ability to send email from a dozen or more email addresses. Any suggestions? Is there a setting in Outlook that I'm missing?
And I actually replied to him via email because it was about a month ago and I knew that it would take us a while to get to this. But essentially in Gmail, I've been using this setting for a couple years now. If you just forward into Gmail and then reply, it'll give you that stupid, you know, so-and-so at Gmail as whoever. And that isn't professional. But if you go into each address and you set up an actual, like a mailbox, instead of just forwarding into Gmail, you set up a mailbox on your mail server, and then you can use Gmail to use POP3, and it will send as them, and no one will know the difference. So I have probably a dozen email addresses from probably 10 different domains that all go into my Gmail account, and then when I click reply, it goes out and uses the POP3 server of that domain. And we're not going to go into the specific details of how to do that in Gmail because it's so painfully boring. But if you go to Google and you type send using SMTP from Gmail. Oh, I realize I've been saying POP3 to send the email. What I meant was send using SMTP. So if you go into Google, type send using SMTP from Gmail, you'll get detailed instructions on that. And you do have to configure each one individually, but then you'll have that professional look of, you know, a dozen addresses all going out of the same inbox.
So the next one's from David Wilson. He says, hello, I love your podcast along with Rob's book. It has been a great help to me while developing my first SaaS app. My question is whether you guys have any experience using Google's SMTP server to send email for web apps, for appointment reminders, app notifications, etc. I have an email address for my app to use from Google Apps and have set up the email backend to send email from this address using Google's SMTP server. This works well in testing, and I like the idea of not having to run a mail server myself. However, I'm not sure if there are any drawbacks to this approach that I'm not aware of. Any thoughts on this configuration or sending email in general? Thanks, David. There's a few different things that you can use. We just switched the Academy over to using one. I think it was, did we use SendGrid?
We're using Postmark at postmarkapp.com. Yeah, it's $1.50 for every 1,000 emails you send.
Right. And then there's other things like SendGrid, and then there's also Elastic Mail, I think it is.
Yep.
So there's a lot of different options, but basically they're hosted SMTP servers, and you sign up for an account, you promise to pay them, I don't know, like a penny for every 10 emails you send or something ridiculously cheap like that. And your emails will basically go through their servers. You call it just as you would a standard SMTP server. Sometimes there's additional authentication code or something like that that you have to include in your email, or sometimes there are changes that you have to make to your DNS servers to prove that you own a specific domain. But by and large, it's a pretty simple and painless process, and it's dirt cheap to send those emails. I mean, if you're sending 10 million emails, obviously it's going to get a little expensive. But for the most part, if you're just sending notifications and reminders and things like that, it will not cost you very much. And for something like a SaaS app, chances are you're charging $10, $20, $30 a month, and you're going to be paying pennies per customer that you have in order to use these services.
Absolutely. I started using Postmark just maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and I will never go back. I told you this, Mike, a couple weeks ago. I mean, I just, the control that you have over it, well, there's a couple layers of it. One is, I can see every email that goes out, and they log it in their web app, and you can, if it gets bounced or if they mark it as spam or if anything happens, it's all marked there. In addition, I caught a bunch of, you know, when you're writing code and you're searching and replacing in an email, you never really know how it looks. You send yourself a test and then that's it, right? But some users' data are different and all that stuff. So I was just flipping through a bunch of them, and I realized that some people had a weird anomaly in their domain name and it was coming out funky in the email. And I went in and fixed it, more professional. In addition, their deliverability is going to be way better than if you try to run an SMTP server from your own server. It's just night and day how much better, how many more emails you're going to be able to deliver if you go through one of these services. So yeah, I will never go back, especially for SaaS apps. I'm sending quite a few emails. As you know, we've talked about, I've been sending some blasts out to older groups of customers. And so I sent 4,500 emails. What was that? It was $6 or something. You know, I mean, it's a complete no-brainer. And I bet the deliverability, I bet between 2 and 5 times more emails got to people because I did not send it through my web server's SMTP server.
And just doing the math on that in terms of what your conversion rate is on those people got to versus the ones that you probably wouldn't have. I mean, that pays the $6 on its own easy.
Right. It pays it for the rest of my life, probably. And yeah, so I would not use Google's SMTP server. It's just not designed to do that. My guess is if you actually started sending any kind of volume that they would flag you, because they don't really want you using it as like an application email address. I would just absolutely bite the bullet. And I'm migrating, like you said, we migrated the Academy over. I'm looking at migrating a couple other apps that I have over, just so I have the control and the visibility. And, you know, there's so much there for a low cost. So to me, it's a no-brainer these days.
So the last question we have is from Justin Shimura, who has emailed us. I think this is his third question, but he says, "Hello, I've got a couple ideas that I've been forming and iterating on. I've come down to choosing a web technology to build them off of, ASP.NET, MVC, or Ruby on Rails. They both seem like really cool technologies. To preface this, I've been a consultant focusing on just .NET and have started a new job for a fairly large city doing .NET work. So my primary business experience is on .NET. I've recently picked up Ruby on Rails and have been playing with it. It seems really cool, but to build a working production app would take me probably twice the time as if I used .NET. With all that in mind, I know you guys are Microsoft developers and have built, maintained, and enhanced .NET web apps. I would like some advice from people that doesn't end with Microsoft sucks. I'm trying to take into consideration cost, difficulty of maintenance, and time of development. Thanks, guys."
When he called us Microsoft developers, did you cringe a little bit?
Just a little bit.
Yeah. But we do. I mean, you and I do most of our development in, we both know other languages, right? I've done PHP and Java, Cold Fusion, and I prefer these days to use PHP, but you and I both have apps written in .NET.
Oh, well, I started off my response by basically saying that I work with pretty much everything. I own computers and devices running Windows, OS X, iOS, AIX, Solaris, HPUX, Linux, and ESX. So if it's a good technology, I'll use it. But that said, all technology sucks in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, it's really important to understand what you're trying to do and why. And the why is the most important part of it. And Justin, if you have any intentions of outsourcing your code, you should seriously consider Ruby on Rails. They've got a great community, and you can generally find programmers who are much cheaper than .NET programmers, or at least that was true a little while ago.
So Ruby on Rails programmers tend to be a little more expensive than PHP and less expensive than .NET and Java, but they are out there.
I mean, the fact is that if you're outsourcing the code, it shouldn't really matter which technology it's in, because it's not about the technology at that point. It's really about all the other things that go into it. In terms of cost, both can be completely free. The Microsoft's got their BizSpark and WebSpark programs. Those are dirt cheap to get into. And sure, they cost money down the road, but you're going to be paying for things one way or another. So, you know, do you want to pay for those software licenses? Yes or no? And if you end up with a host provider, it's very possible that they could be providing those things for you. I mean, you don't need to buy a SQL Server license. You can essentially rent a SQL Server database from most hosting providers. On the Linux side, yeah, you can run Ruby on Rails over there. MySQL is probably going to be a little bit less expensive in terms of hosting costs. But at the end of the day, your hosting costs are going to be far less than your costs of development. And that's in terms of the time that it takes whoever it is to develop it times their hourly rate.
It's assuming they don't have some specific limitations, right? Like with Hittail, since I have such high IO, disk IO, I actually do have some very specific hosting requirements. And the Windows stuff is substantially more expensive than Linux. But that's a special case. And for most SaaS apps that are just doing basic, you know, putting stuff in a database and taking it out, you're right. You're going to get a VPS for, you know, $100 or $150 either way, right?
I mean, the only other thing I mentioned to him was that you really need to consider the time to market. And if it'll take you 100 hours to build it in .NET, do you want to spend 200 hours doing it in Ruby on Rails? And if you want the experience, go for it. You know, if you're not looking for that experience, does it really make sense going through and making all the mistakes that you need to make in order to get the software to where it needs to be? That's a judgment call that you're going to have to make either way.
Yep. If you don't know Ruby at all and you're going to outsource it, I would be hesitant to outsource a Ruby app, only because if you're a .NET developer, you're going to get it built and you're going to launch, there's going to be tiny little tweaks, tiny little fixes, little things you want to add. And that becomes a pain in the butt when you can't just go in and tweak your own code. So I would say be careful of that. And I'm not saying don't do it in Ruby. If you were a Ruby developer looking at doing it in .NET, I would give you the exact same advice the other way. So it's language agnostic. It's more of what you know. Are you really interested in learning Ruby? Are you really interested in learning this moving forward? Because if you're not, then I would probably not do it in Ruby. I would stick with the core competency because the technology doesn't matter, right? No one's going to know when they're using the app what technology it's written in. Yes,
well, they may know, but they won't care.
They won't care. That's a good point. The bottom line is if you were, you know, a quasi-expert in Java, .NET, Ruby, PHP, and Python, then there would actually be a question where we could say, well, which one actually has the best development community? Which one is best for web development or SaaS app development? And we could get into a philosophical discussion about that, probably not worth it. You could also say which might have the most, if you ever plan to sell it, which one might be easier. And it's probably going to be PHP or Ruby, in my experience. That's going to be the easiest to sell that people are more willing to take over. And if I was going to build something completely from scratch, knowing the languages I know, I tend to lean towards PHP because I know it. I know that Ruby has a better web development framework and, you know, debatably, from what I've heard, it does. I wouldn't go with it just because I don't know it and I don't want to take the time to learn it right now. I think my recommendation, Justin, is if you really want to learn Ruby, then, you know, go ahead and do it. And if you don't, if you're kind of just thinking, which technology should I use, and you want to get it done fast, then I think sticking with your core competency. If that's what you know, and you really don't want to learn something new, you really just want to get an app out, then that would tend to be my recommendation.
On the surface, what you said earlier about if you're a .NET developer, then outsourcing to have somebody write it in Ruby on Rails is probably a bad idea. And if you're a Ruby on Rails developer, outsourcing somebody to write something in .NET is probably a bad idea. You mentioned things like once you go into production, you have to make little tweaks and things like that. Most people who are building businesses or who are entrepreneurs, you know, tend to be decent developers or at the very least think they are and feel like they could probably go through and debug things. But the issue I think you'll run into is that there are going to be times where you don't necessarily have the time to mess around with it. Somebody's got a problem and you want to or you need to fix it quickly. And because you're not familiar enough with the development environment and the debugging techniques, it's going to take you much, much longer to do it.
Right. And so I guess for, you know, we have a lot of listeners that are not developers. And so for them, they would just ask the general question, like, what should I develop my next app in? If they're really going to build an app, I would actually, based purely on availability of labor, cost of developers, ability to sell it later on if you want to, and just good frameworks, I would probably go with PHP. I may go with Ruby on Rails. I would go with one of those two. What do you think?
I think I'd probably lean towards PHP or Ruby on Rails. I mean, like you said, it's more just because of the sellability later on and, you know, the availability of the programmers who do that kind of thing. I think that you'd have a much easier time finding them. I think that it'd be significantly more cost effective, or at least, you know, more cost effective. Yep. And if you don't know anything about it, but what difference does it make what it's written in, because you can't fix it anyway, not because it actually makes a technical difference. Because like I said, your customers don't care. It could be written in VB6 or Delphi. And I know that there are production applications out there that are still selling today that are written with those, and they still sell, and they still sell well.
Absolutely. Hittail is written in classic ASP. Man, that was deprecated in 2001 when .NET 1.0 came out. But it's absolutely still functioning and going. So, and no one, you know, who's using it is going to know the difference. If you didn't listen to this podcast, you wouldn't be able to tell.
But Microsoft is trying to get rid of it. You can tell by if you do a Windows 2008 install and you install IIS, ASP is not selected by default.
Totally.
Yeah, you have to manually tell it to say include this.
No, I did. I did when we did the new server. And in fact, obviously my ultimate goal is to get off of classic ASP and move to a different technology, either ASP.NET MVC or something else. I mean, but it just goes to show you, I mean, Hittail has a heavy volume. It's going to have a heavier volume than probably 99% of the SaaS apps that anyone's going to want to build. And it functions just fine.
But I do have a question. You said you would port Hittail to ASP MVC or something along those lines.
Yep.
Why wouldn't you, if you're doing a port, why wouldn't you port it to PHP or Ruby on Rails?
I have thought quite a bit about this. The migration path from ASP to like ASP.NET MVC is quite easy because they can both coexist on the same server, easily share cookies. There's a path there. Whereas if I go with PHP, I basically have to rewrite all the code at once, create this monolithic new thing, and then migrate everyone to it. Also, everything's in the SQL Server 2005 backend. It's a 250 gig database with literally more than a billion rows. I don't exactly want to move that into Postgres or MySQL. So I have some reasons to stay with the Microsoft stack just because, again, if I was doing it from scratch, I would probably go with PHP and I would go with Node.js as the, you know, the tracking part where the JavaScript calls back, because there's so much traffic going through there and Node.js handles a lot of requests really, really well. I would want to move to a Linux box. I would use PostgreSQL and I would go with PHP Node.js. And that's a massive undertaking. Even with this app as, you know, quote unquote small as it is, as I've looked at it and tried to spec it out, it would be big. Whereas with moving to ASP.NET, whether it's web forms or MVC, I could do it gradually over the course of a year or two and just do a piece of, rewrite a piece of it at a time and kind of leave the database intact and leave everything else intact.
I just thought that the listeners would probably find it interesting as to why you would not make that leap. But
yeah, and
I know you have good reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I would be totally up for discussing it at some point, because I spent a lot of time early on. I mean, as I was going to acquire it, I started looking through the code and I was like, good grief, like I really want to just get all this rewritten. I don't want to pay for the hosting is absolutely more expensive, may even be twice as much on the Windows stack, since I do have such heavy volume and I need a full processor license or multiprocessor license of SQL Server. I need a lot of things that would be much cheaper on the Linux stack. But yeah, the cost and or effort to do that would, it just would completely not be worth it at this point. It wouldn't be worth paying itself back. So always open to discussions and stuff about that, because I did put a lot of time and effort into, you know, figuring out how I would do that later on.
Cool.
If you have a question or comment, please call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690. You can email it to us in text or MP3 format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes. Let's see, there's at least 71 ratings for us right now. Just go into iTunes and search for Startups, and we're in the top 3 podcasts. You can subscribe to it in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. And a full transcript of this podcast is always available at our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.